Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, welcome to the Eggonomics podcast, the podcast about rugby and business. Now, you're probably listening to this on the Egg Chasers feed, but if you're not, why don't you go and visit our other podcast, Egg Chasers, with me, Tim and Phil. And if you want even more rugby content, go and visit Tim Cocker on his ever-expanding, world-dominating YouTube channel with loads and loads of great content. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm Jonathan Beardmore. Or in fact, you can find me at Beardmore & Co. Independent Financial Advisors for all things pensions, investments and financial planning. However, let's be honest, that's not the reason you're listening to this podcast. You're listening because I'm about to be joined by Mark Evans, ex-CEO of Harlequins, formerly of the NRL, currently of Drura and absolutely a rugby business guru. Mark, how are you?
I'm good, JB. You know, 2 wins in a row the last couple of weeks, so we're pretty buoyant.
Now, just before the podcast started, we were chatting about the weather over in Fiji. We had an email, and this email was praising you guys for actually playing the game when a lot of people would have called it off.
Yes, it's tricky because to call things off, it's really got to be completely unplayable because rescheduling the game is very hard. People have booked on flights and, you know, it's a long way from anywhere and you push your opposition into a 5-day turnaround, particularly when they're from Perth, which is a 14, 15-hour trip anyway.
Crikey.
There's a lot of incentive to get the thing off. And also, the pitch was in quite good nick in the sense it had a lot of grass on it. There wasn't much mud at the beginning. It's rained for the last 2 weeks. It stopped for the game day last week against the Waratahs. We had a lovely day, and then it poured at halftime for 10 minutes, and then it was fine. But this time, it rained most of the week, and then it rained all day on match day, and it was pretty miserable in the sense that, you know, not a great experience, but, we played very well.
Do you really think it's not a great experience? And this is where I get a little bit tense with some of the comments around weather conditions and pitches. Like the one game I would most like to have attended of all the games in all the sports would be the Minnesota game in the record cold when the beer was freezing as they were tipping it in their mouths. I mean, that to me is what it's all about.
Well, we have to recognise that if we play between January and actually this is a bit late, it's meant to be finished now. There's a chance it's going to get very, very wet, and we live in a tropical country, so we just have to accept that's the risk we run. And the players don't mind. I mean, they play a lot of rugby in the wet when they're growing up, and they quite enjoy it.
It's glorious,
and they're pretty good at it. I mean, it's a stadium where not a lot of people are undercover. Everyone has to take umbrellas. It's very squelchy and it's just a bit physically unpleasant. I mean, and the roads get very hard to pass. So
yeah.
The crowd drops. So there's a financial hit that you have to absorb. So all in all, we'd rather play in 93 degrees with 85% humidity and take our home advantage that way rather than playing in a tropical downpour. But, you know,
It's those games that you remember. I mean, I hate it when they call off the game for snow on the pitch. Even if it's not frosted underneath. Snow on the pitch, that's a glorious thing.
Snow on the pitch is great. Frost, not so much. But I think if anyone wants to actually have a look, go onto YouTube and just put in Derby Waratah, Derby Force. And there are some fantastic pictures. There really are some great pictures.
Excellent, excellent. So I think what we're going to talk about today is the Premiership financial results. We spoke about it a tiny bit on Air Chasers, but as a man who's on the front lines dealing with these financial results, just what are your initial impressions about the whole thing?
Well, there's a lot of debt.
There is a lot of
debt.
There's
an awful debt. I mean, people tend to concentrate on the profit and loss account, but I think, and that really, you need to be looking at the levels of debt. I mean, I obviously, you know, always prepare. So in preparation for this pod, I took a team that probably amongst the, you know, traditionally one of the stronger teams of England, but whichever metric you use, Leicester Tigers. And you look at their accounts and they made an operating loss. Okay, well, so did virtually every club. Some made more than others. Saracens lost the most. I think Gloucester, Sale and Saints lost hardly, well, $500,000, which is about as low as it got. Mm. But they've got about $30 million worth of debt. Others have got more. So this is by no means the worst case. They owe money to, they've got a bank loan to HSBC at 2% above base. They've got $7 million owing to the government through the COVID loan. They've got $12 million of directors' loans in, and they've got an overdraft of $4 million.
Yeah.
So you add all of that, and you know, that's an all, and they've got a negative cash flow of 2.5.
Yeah.
Which means to those, to our listeners who are not particularly financially interested, that simply means that you have to find £2.5 million worth of cash to keep the lights on, because the cash going out is more than the cash coming in. Mind you, the year before, which was much more COVID affected, it was £7.4 million negative cash flow. Now, this is a club. My point here is this is a club that is still in many ways the biggest in England. I still think it's got the largest membership.
It has.
If you strip out the marquee games of Twickenham, Tottenham, that sort of thing, they've probably still got the highest average attendance of any club in the league. But they're turning over about 22 million if you take out exceptionals. So that's a lot of debt to carry on a turnover of 22 million. And you look at where their money comes from. People say, well, more bums on seats. Yeah, but ticket sales only amount to about 5 million.
That's crazy.
And commercial, which is hospitality, merchandise, sponsorship, is double that, nearly 10.
Yeah.
And they're one of the more commercially astute clubs in the league. And then Central comes to just under 5, and that's where you add those up. It's around about 20, but the rats and mice says you 21.
Yeah, so just taking the conversation back a bit, I don't think people who are, you know, who aren't in finance understand the severity of the COVID loan situation. So the COVID loan situation in the wider economy is really serious. I do a lot of networking with an insolvency practitioner, and as these COVID loans start to become due, the amount of small business which is going under is frightening. And if you look at these figures for rugby clubs, they're not big businesses. At very best, they are medium-sized businesses. Yeah. It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me one bit.
Well, the highest turnover in the land now in the league is Harlequins, who turn over, by which we mean their income, their about 30 million. That's about that. That's about their revenue, if you like, which is a pretty good effort.
Yeah, that's great.
But they still lose they still lost 3.6 million on the P&L, and they've still got £33 million pounds worth of debt. So I think it's fair to say that, and the COVID loans are only just about, have only just started to be repaid. Now they're fairly low rate of interest. I think they're at 2%.
Yeah.
And I do apologize to get any some of these numbers maybe are not 100% accurate. They're as accurate as I can get them, not being directly involved these days. But look, the other thing that you've got is you look to the balance sheet and say, well, look, are these clubs worth much in terms of if you folded them tomorrow, do their assets outweigh their liabilities, putting it very, very simply. And someone like Leicester Tigers, you know, they get £80 million worth of assets on the balance sheet, but it's nearly all property. It's the stadium.
Yeah.
And in their case, the training ground as well. Well, you can't actually monetize that without closing the joint down.
Well, this is exactly what happened to Worcester, isn't it? You've got basically a profitable business. Well, not a profitable business. Lots of businesses around there that could be potentially profitable with this one loss-making entity, which is the rugby club. So any criminal-minded, and I know probably that's probably too strong, anyone business-minded with ill intentions can look at that and go, well, if you close down the rugby side, we've got one hell of a car park and we've got a hell of a stadium.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's obvious.
If located in a certain area, the asset value is significant, but of course, in order to realise the asset, you've got to close down the rugby.
Exactly.
Which is why sports clubs have always been susceptible to asset strippers. But that hasn't been the case largely in rugby union in England. But what has happened over the best part of 30 years now is there has been it's fascinating, a point-blank refusal by different people over time, a long time, 30 years is a long time in business, a point blank refusal for a whole myriad of reasons to sort out the business model so that clubs were largely operating within their means.
Yes.
And now, of course, there are some clubs that have got more income than others. At the moment, the lowest I can find, the lowest turnover is probably, funnily enough, Bristol are pretty low.
Bristol, really?
15 million, Sale at 16. But Bristol, you'd have to go into more depth about what sits in Bristol sports and what sits in Bristol rugby. And look, we haven't got time for that on this podcast. No. I mean, you can do it. I'm nerdy enough to have done it, but let's not go there.
Isn't the Sale figure more like 11 million turnover and 17
million? I saw that number quoted in a newspaper article, but when I went and looked at the accounts,
yeah,
I think it's 16, not 11, as far as I can make out. But give me more time in terms of heads up on what we're talking about.
Not 48 hours,
I'll do more research.
Yeah, but
look, at the end of the day, it's pretty worrying in the sense that on the current cost base, and you know, you look at these are people businesses. Okay, so let's go back to Leicester Tigers because all credit to Leicester Tigers, they're a PLC and their numbers are very visible and in the public domain and easy to access. Just go to their website. Others are much harder to find. I'm looking at you, Bath Rugby. And they've got 187 people on the staff.
Crikey.
95 of whom are in playing and coaching.
That's quite large.
The salary bill is 13.6 million out of revenue of 21. So two-thirds of the turnover goes to pay people.
Yeah.
Look, you ain't got to be John Maynard Keynes to work out that that's a business that is probably living beyond its means. And, of course, this is the classic sports problem. You've got to ask yourself, why do clubs do that? And the answer is...
Sorry, Mark. Can you just hold that?
Because they want to win.
Just hold that thought. I've got Buzz on the line. Let me just make sure I can get rid of it.
It's really bad now. All right. A technical buzz or some kind of insect?
No, a technical buzz. So... gone.
That'll go in the edit.
Yes, it will. Sorry, just remind me, why do they want to do it?
Well, partly it's because sports leagues are a good example of a market failure.
Okay.
And market forces are wonderful things, and I'm a big fan in most sectors. However, in certain sectors, they are quite destructive. You know, there's two problems, major problems with market forces, as any economist will tell you. One is it tends to generate monopoly power, mm-hmm. either monopoly of production or monopsony, a single supplier, and they get far too much market power and they have to be regulated. And then there are certain other things that markets just don't provide very well, usually because of externalities, in other words, things that can't be priced. The classic example is the pollution, which is suffered by everybody, generated by a particular activities who often don't have to pay anything.
Yes.
And then it get cleaned up elsewhere. And if you don't regulate that, then you know, you're going to have all kinds of problems. The problem within sport is if you let market forces operate untrammeled over a period of time, you will lose something. I suppose this is sports externalities, is you will lose competitive balance unless you are an incredibly large market. So where's the best example? Well, the best example is in the biggest sport of all. Look at football. You've got a situation now, it's only taken, when was the maximum wage in football abolished? Early 1960s. It's only taken 65 years or so for every single world-class footballer to be plying their trade in one of four European leagues.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter whether you're Brazilian or Swedish or Angolan or Australian. If you are a world-class footballer, you'll be playing in England, Spain, Italy, or Germany.
Yes.
You might be playing for one of the two or three very, very large sovereign wealth-owned French clubs like PSG or Marseille. But on the whole, you'll be in one of those four leagues. Doesn't matter where you're from. Why? Well, because if you don't regulate and you don't intervene and you let market forces, you get effectively a form of monopoly power. The big get bigger. What do they do with it? They put the money back into the team, so they get a better team, so they win more games, so they generate more revenue, and they get into a virtuous circle. They don't necessarily make money. Look at Real Madrid, and their current travails.
Well, look at Barcelona.
They're too big to fail, though. They are. They are just too big to fail.
So I'm on the fence with this somewhat. So...
Well, get off it, JB. Come on.
Okay, so you are correct that they do tend towards monopolies. But then I don't think you solve this problem with regulation. And I think the FIFA financial fair play thing is exactly an example of this. So the financial fair play, in my mind, is an effort not for fair play, but it's an effort to make sure the biggest clubs remain the biggest clubs. Because they've already got the biggest turnover, and therefore, if you are somebody new on the block, a Saudi prince, for instance, who wants to spend all of his money, not even a Saudi prince can spend their way to the top now because of the financial fair play rules. To me, this is a classic example of the biggest players, like in the real world, in any industry, wanting regulation to protect themselves, not to protect the smaller participants. What does protect the smaller participants is true competition. You might say that
you are completely and utterly mistaken.
But I am completely and utterly correct on this example of regulation.
No. What you've got in football, and financial fair play is an interesting example, is you've got a sport that historically has been completely unregulated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to see what happens in a smaller market, without any regulation, go no further than Scottish football, where only one of two teams will ever win it.
Yes.
Going forward. Okay. Now, there you have an example of untrammeled market forces leading to a duopoly. and in my mind, a complete lack of interest. Others disagree. I do know that. But if you want to go and see sports where a whole load of intervention has taken place over a long period of time, the two countries you go to are either Australia or the United States.
Agreed, yeah.
And there you have sports, nearly all of the sports, in fact, who do a whole pile of things. It's not simply one thing. Who do a whole pile of things to try and ensure competitive balance and uncertainty of outcome. In other words, a bit like the Premiership's got this year.
I was about to say that.
By default.
Yeah.
But at the same time, what it also does is it means that very few clubs, I'm going to say very few clubs as it gets more mature, run into the serious financial problems that the Premiership has seen. Because, and here's where, if you want, why has English rugby got into this state and why have we run 35 years of losses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It is very boringly, and people have heard, who've listened to me before will now be yawning, it's down to governance and structure.
Yeah, I agree.
Most of those leagues do not allow a participant-based board to run the league. Mm. And there are lots of other things as well, so this is not a single issue complaint.
Explain to our listeners, what does that mean, a participants-based board?
Well, it means if you have a board that runs the league made up of its participants, mm-hmm. there is an immediate conflict of interest.
Okay.
It takes a very, very fair and brave man or woman to vote through something that will damage their individual club.
Yes.
Even though it may well be in the interests of the league in the long run. That's what I mean. So if you look at the best run leagues, sporting leagues in the world, they are run usually through some kind of independent commission.
Yes.
Separated from the participants. If you like, it's the difference between shareholders and executives in the business world. And our problem in, if we're being very localized here with the English Premiership, which is what we're talking about, is that for most of its existence, they've had a shareholder board and the executive have not been empowered.
Right. So just on that one, I do completely agree with you that the Premiership owners in particular fight like cats in a bag because they all want to win the league. I mean, there's no two ways about it.
In all sports do.
Well, yes. And I think in the Premiership,
let the people who fight to win the league run the league is my point.
Yeah, but the small difference I would make is the people that want to win the league in the NFL also run the league. Now, they run it through a commissioner. But the really interesting part about that is the commissioner is there not for the benefit of the league. He's there for the benefit of the owners. But they just tend to look at it through a different lens, which is the benefit of the league is the benefit of the owners.
JB, those types of structures run the league in the interests of the collective. That's what they do. And trust me, I've sat round quite a long time ago now, but I sat around Premiership board table for well over a decade.
Mm.
And I could point to innumerable occasions when things that would have benefited the league got voted down because they were against the interests of two or three clubs. Let's take one most recently that I'm sure all of our listeners will be aware of, because you don't listen to this podcast unless you're a bit of a rugby nerd. Look at those numbers we've just talked about. You know, most clubs with debts, carrying debt well over 30 million, one or two closer to 50. And that's including clubs who've written off a whole load of debt that are no longer showing on the balance sheet. Mm. With P&L losses over 5 million in some cases, nobody profitable, although three or four, close to it. And as you said, relatively small businesses.
Mm.
And yet still the salary cap goes up next year by 1.4 million.
I think that's mad.
And that is just madness. And you have to ask yourself, though, how has that happened? And it's happened because of governance, because on certain issues, all you have to get, and I'm not sure if it's 4 now, because it isn't 12 anymore, is it? Maybe I don't know what the number is. Maybe now it's only 3. Mm. But the point is, for on certain issues, a very small, quite a small minority of the clubs involved can block any change. Yeah. And to get the COVID reductions through, the compromise was that it would go back to a certain level at a certain time, unless, I think at the time, 9 out of the 12 clubs voted against it. So effectively, you get 3 who wouldn't, you're fine. And that's what's happened. So you've got this ludicrous situation where clubs are heavily indebted, just about to start to pay, have to pay back the COVID loans, carrying with cash flow problems across many of them, reliant on their owners or owner putting in more equity capital, as happened at Leicester Tigers last year when 13 million of equity went in to keep the cash flow going. And yet they have voluntarily agreed to stick another 1.4 million on their cost base. It really does beggar belief.
Well, we're talking about market forces. To me, this is the ultimate example. I mean, the Premiership wants to play ball with the French League. And as that French League is growing and expanding, and their second division is, and their third division is fully professional now, they believe, and I think they're right, that if they don't expand their cost base, and I think this is probably why the RFU are going to end up giving them a shed load more money, even more money overall than when they had 13 teams. So across the 10 teams, they'll get more money than when they had 13 teams. The reason that they're doing that is because they know they're going to end up in a situation like Super League and the NRL. And that's, I said this on Egg Chasers, that's how it's going to go. The best players are not actually going to be bothered by England. In fact, England's threat that you can't play international rugby, they'll just shrug their shoulders. Who cares? I've got a contract in the top 14, which is guaranteed. I don't need to be subject to the whims of an international coach like Zach Mercer, for example. I'll just get a huge boatload of cash over in France. And that's the problem. They're competing in an open market against the French.
As an avid listener to the Mothership podcast, I heard that, your exposition earlier. Is it today or yesterday? I lose track.
I'm not sure. Today. You mean today?
Absolutely nonsensical. It's just not simply... Look, I've been around the game long enough when I remember that when the English League was bigger than the French League.
Yep.
And people like Castanier and Caban and Serge Betson and Ibanez all came out by their trade in England. Do you think the French fixed that by throwing loads of money at it? Or do you think they took the view, which they did, but actually they had a whole lot of issues they had to get over and get their house in order.
Oh, well,
and then, and England will never catch up. If England genuinely thinks, and the English clubs genuinely think, that they will ever reach the levels of income that the French League can reach, they are completely misguided.
Yeah.
And the reason is very, very simple. And here is where market forces do operate and will always operate. It is in the size of the audience. Mm. So the French rugby market has about 24 million people in it. In other words, what I mean by that is what slice of the population of a country holds rugby or anything else as its number one sport? The largest rugby union market in the world by a distance is France.
Yeah.
Right. The next highest is, well, it depends how you define South Africa but basically England is the second. But in the same way, it's a bit like saying, well, let's take a really storied football country. Why doesn't Portugal catch up with La Liga? Well, it's patently obvious, isn't it?
Yeah.
Spain's got 48 million people and Portugal's got 9. Therefore, television domestic broadcast fees, which is the absolute building block of any league, are going to be higher in Spain than they are in Portugal, and they always will be. They will always be higher in France than they are in England, in the same way that they will always be higher in England than they are in Wales.
Yes, I completely agree
with this. So if you go chasing the biggest market without the population and the penetration into that population, right, and that's the case in England, because England and French populations are roughly the same, but the penetration of rugby is way higher and has always been way higher in France. It's now just been monetized.
Yeah.
Stop it. That's all I can say to people is, please stop it. You're chasing the wrong target.
Well,
football in, let's say, Holland is still incredibly strong, but all the Dutch players play overseas.
Well, hang on a second.
Of course they do.
So I think,
of course they do.
I think we're talking about two slightly separate things here. So I think you've given a very good explanation of why the Premiership shouldn't be doing what they're doing. I agree with you. They shouldn't be doing what they're doing. All I'm saying is the reason they are doing it is because of the market pressure applied by the French. Now, I don't believe what they're doing is wise. In fact, the best way I can describe this is it's like a fund manager chasing a loss after a bad investment. They take more risk and they compound the problem that they've already got. That's what we're seeing.
They only need to look at other rugby markets to show that that is just not the way, not the response. Let's put it that way. That is not the correct response. Let me ask you a question. What's the salary cap in Australian rugby union below the Wallabies?
I've got no idea.
Places like people like the Waratahs and the Reds and all that guys in Super Rugby, they've got five of them at the moment. They're going to go to four next year. But
I'm going to guess it's like $4 million or something. I have no idea.
$4 million what?
Oh, crikey. That's a good point. I've got no idea. No idea.
Well, I'll tell you. All right. It was a tricky question. I do accept. Okay. The Australian cap for all of its five provinces or states or whatever you want to call them, franchises, is $5.5 million Aussie dollars, which is roughly about just under £3 million.
Okay.
Okay. My point is this, and the New Zealand cap isn't much higher. Okay. Only it's in New Zealand dollars, of course. But it's not much higher either. Okay. Yes, there are central contracts over the top of that, which some players get, but many don't. Does that mean, and New Zealand's maybe a better example, does that mean that people immediately leave New Zealand at the age of 21? No, it doesn't. Some do, but lots don't.
But just on New Zealand.
And does everybody leave Australia?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And rugby, no. Why? Well, a whole load of things. One, a lot of them still want to play for the All Blacks and they want to play for the Wallabies.
Yep.
And to a degree still, it's harder to do that. Well, the All Blacks still won't pick you from overseas.
Yeah.
Wallabies will pick some, but they understand, and I've heard you and Tim berating this, but you're wrong, saying, oh, no, it's outrageous. You just let players go and play wherever. You want soccer, right? You want everyone to go to that league.
Absolutely not. I do not want soccer, for the record. I do not want
that. Well, in that case, why do you keep bleating on about players should just be allowed to play for England if they're playing wherever they like?
Because I think that's an issue of basic morality. I mean,
that's soccer, mate. That's soccer. Why, in that, if you let them play anywhere and then still pick them for your national team. Yeah, well, you are Belgian football then. If that's all you aspire to, you are Belgian football.
Well,
or you're Argentinian rugby, because Argentina haven't got a professional team, so they have to play overseas.
But this idea that every nation should come up with a solution which works for itself.
I agree with that.
There is definitely a moral component, there is 100% a moral component. Like, you're asking lads, particularly with all, I mean, do I subscribe to all of the concussion horror stories? Absolutely not. Do I subscribe to all of the health stories? To a degree. But we are asking lads to take one hell of a risk with their bodies. And I think if you're going to ask them to do that, they've got to be well compensated, and they deserve to be as well compensated as they can possibly be. Now,
if you'd stopped at the comma instead of going to the end of that last sentence, I was with you.
Go on. What was the end of the sentence, Richard?
The end of the sentence, as much as they possibly can be.
Yes.
No. What they have the right to do is, if they want to go and play in Japan and France, which are the only two markets in the world which pay more than the English market. England is ranked three. And both France and Japan limit the number of overseas players in their league. Mm-hmm. The French do it through the GIF system plus an overseas quota. The Japanese do it purely on a quota. And the unions run that. They decide how many overseas players they will let into their national league.
Yeah.
I don't see any moral difference between a union deciding that and a union saying, like New Zealand does, look, the whole of the game in this country, from under sixes all the way through the schools, universities, etc., all goes up to the All Blacks. It's built on the whole game. It's incredibly important to us culturally. And if you don't want to play in New Zealand, fine. Absolutely, you've got the right to go and work overseas. But we've also got the right to say we will only pick people who play domestically.
Yes.
You can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, the player can go and work wherever they like and they must be picked for their home nation. That's ridiculous.
Well, there is definitely still an element of morality that you don't limit people's livelihoods and you don't limit their standards of living. I still strongly believe that.
Were you pro or anti-Brexit?
Pro. Absolutely pro.
Yeah. So you were in favour of limiting the movement of Labour then?
Yes.
Which is what you said.
Let me just stop you there on the Brexit point. I'm in favour of deciding the limit of the country's labour supply based on the needs of the country. Now, there was nothing.
That's what I said.
There was nothing.
That's what I'm
saying. Yeah, there was
the needs of the national team. You decide the labour conditions. You can't. JB, you can't have it both ways, mate.
Well, you can, because you divide up, wouldn't you, between saying what are the needs of the Premiership owners, okay, and what are the needs of the national team. So the Premiership owners are interested in one thing, which is providing us with one of the best sporting products that you can watch on TV. And in order to do that, we all know what the value is of overseas stars. So I'm fine with that. Where it gets muddy.
I keep interrupting.
No, please.
I learned this many, many, many years ago, that is a complete and utter myth.
That is not a myth.
When in 1997, at the dawn of professionalism, I was at Saracens, I was head coach, and we signed Philippe Seller, Michael Leiner, and Francois Pienaar. We also signed such luminaries as Paddy Johns, Kieran Bracken, both the Wallace brothers, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. It was an extraordinary squad. And when we signed those three global superstars, if rugby ever had a global superstar other than Jonah Lomu, which I would doubt, and maybe Johnny, I thought the crowd would flock in.
Yep.
Did not move the dial. The thing that moved the dial came about 18 months later with a bloke from Oldham called Peter Deakin, who taught us how to market sports events.
He moved the dial.
Nothing to do with glamorous overseas players. Otherwise, Do you not think by now Sale and Newcastle, who have signed some really very, very well-known players over the years, not just, no, it could go back 10, 15, 20, 30 years. It's been going that long. If it was as simple as, let's sign a bunch of well-known players, that'll fix it, it would have been fixed by now.
Well, I don't think it is as simple as signing just well-known players. I think it's part of a multifactorial equation. But you definitely need some very good players. And I'll give you an example of that. I mean, you don't need a world-class player in every position, but Finn Russell has 100% made a difference to attendances in Bath. There is no
two ways. No, he hasn't.
Oh, he has.
No, he hasn't. He's made a difference to the team. But, JB, Bath have been sold out for every game for about the last 5 seasons. Mm. When they were rare, that was so admirable about the people of Bath. When they were really, really poor, they still kept coming out in the rain with no roof and sitting there watching their team. It's absolutely fantastic. If we had 16 cities or towns where rugby was that popular, we wouldn't be where we are now.
But it doesn't
be able to play from the cost.
But it doesn't just have to be the stadium, right? So, for instance, when the rugby is on TV now, I will make an extra effort to watch Bath because I want to see it. You know, so it's not just necessarily bums on seats. It's eyeballs on the TV. It's YouTube clicks. It's all these things.
But you're not a new eyeball, are you, JB? You would be, if you weren't watching Bath, you'd be watching somebody else. So the net effect.
I'm not a great example of this. To be fair, Mark, I will hand you that. But Finn Russell is a great example of a player who does extraordinary things and brings eyeballs to the game. You don't even need to know who he is. You just need to watch him play. And you go, bloody hell, what is that?
But it's honestly, if we're talking about audience is far more about cultural affinity and participation and connection with any sport, right? Rather than, let's just buy the best players.
It's got to be
otherwise, you know, let me give you an example from where I am now at the moment. We accept, the whole country accepts, that at around 26, 27, we hope, much later than it used to be, the very best Fijian players will leave and go to Japan or France.
Yes.
And maybe one or two in the Premiership. Okay? That's a fact of life that we can't change. But that doesn't mean we can't build a product here that will get huge numbers of people watching it on TV, lots of people coming to the ground and piles of sponsors. The fact that we have to accept that after a period of time, our very best players will leave is just, we can't fight that bit of economics.
Yes.
Okay?
Which is the same economics that...
What we have... But that also, however, won't necessarily stop people coming to watch us if we do a really good job. It's about connecting people to the sport. And we'll come back to France.
Yep.
Why may have higher budgets? Why can they pay higher wages? Because they have a bigger audience than England do. We should be spending our time talking about how we grow the audience, and goodness me, if the last 30 years have shown us anything, just spending more money on player salaries does not do it.
I completely agree.
It's self-evident.
So
we should stop worrying about France. Let's just stop, please. Can we all just stop worrying about players going to France? If they go to France, fine.
But
one of England's great natural advantages is it has probably more than France, actually, not many more, but a little bit more. We have more people, more, in this case, boys playing rugby than virtually any country in the world.
Over double the next biggest country.
Why on earth are we worried? There's so many things to fix in the game in England. Why are we obsessing with this idea that we somehow have to copy or match France? We can't.
Just on that point.
We can do a much better job than we are doing.
Yeah, just on that point, you know, I think you're almost making my point for me, which is if we just let all the players go, if you just let all the players go to France, we don't need to worry about France. You know, you don't need to worry about it. You only need to worry about France if you're trying to keep your players in position. Yeah, and eventually, what will happen?
What I'm saying is, couple of things. A, not nearly as many players will go.
No, but the good ones will. The best ones will.
No, they won't.
Just like the NRL and Super League.
No. That is a complete false analogy. I'm sorry. That's not true.
Tell you why they won't all go.
Why the false analogy? The NRL, Rugby League's only played in England, Australia and Papua New Guinea.
Okay.
And bits in New Zealand. So the number of overseas players that can go to the NRL is very limited by country. Mm-hmm. Far, far fewer than rugby union.
Yeah.
In France, you can recruit Kiwis, Australians, South Africans, Argentinians, Georgians, etc. Welsh, Scottish, blah, blah, blah. Right? They also have quite strict quotas on overseas players. So the number of English players, what would happen or what will happen, right? And I think this is a small price to pay, is some well-known players, primarily over the age of 28, mm-hmm. with one or two outliers,
yep.
will go. It's happened to New Zealand for years. It's happened to Australia for years. It's happened to South Africa for years. It's happened to Scotland for years.
Yep.
Much, much smaller countries. Why are we so obsessed with it?
Well,
I read article after article that somehow paints this as some kind of the game's in crisis because they're going to France.
No, the game's in crisis.
It's nonsense.
The game's in crisis because they don't know what to do about it, not because the players are going to France. That's like the least. That's least of their problems. You know, I think the problem with the best players going to France is,
which they're not, but carry on.
Well, okay, let's just have a little list of the players. Courtney Laws, Manu Tuilagi, Kyle Sinclair.
Hold on a minute.
Yeah, go on.
Whoa. Courtney Laws and Manu Tuilagi. Oh, come on.
Big names, though.
Look, that's like saying, well, when Dan Carter went, New Zealand went into crisis. He was 34.
Yeah, these guys aren't 34. On. Kyle Sinclair's not 34. The current England captain has stepped away. And now there's reasons he says, I'm not sure I believe him, but there's reasons that he says he has. Then you've got the second tier, like the Simmons brothers and Mercer and Willis.
Hold on a minute.
Willis is
all... Hold on a minute. You've gone from saying the best players, and within half sentence and a half, you're saying the second tier.
Yeah, so there's both, isn't
there? Well, Marcus, the very top, Atoji, right?
Not yet.
George.
But
hold on a minute. Now we're going into...
But here is my point, right? If you're losing those players, and the second level are important too, the reason they're important is because when I spoke before about needing the best players from overseas to supplement your team, again, it's multifactorial. What people love is a team which is a mix of your homegrown superstars, like your Martin Johnsons, but then supplemented by your Pat Howards. That's what they love. They like to see that the hometown heroes can be supplemented by some of the best in the world and neither look out of place, like a Toulouse, like so many of the French clubs. And that's what they've got right. Now, if you're stripping out your homegrown players and also you're not bringing in the best in the world, what are you left with as a spectacle?
Which is a bit like saying, you know, if we can't be the biggest market in the world, we don't want to play.
No, it's like saying, why don't we be like Dutch football?
No. Just listen to yourself, right, and for a minute, right? Okay. We're the second biggest market in world rugby.
Mm-hmm.
And we are paranoid because there's one market bigger than us.
Yeah.
What is the matter with it, with England, with large groups of the England rugby public, that somehow this is an affront to the game?
Well,
honestly, I just don't get it.
I
don't also believe that players, it's a bit like saying, take another sport again, you know. People don't. I don't believe. Maybe we just disagree on this one. I don't believe. I think people follow the the club and the entity, not the individuals. I do.
And
as you also know, this is multi-factor, as you know, I'm against promotion and relegation, et cetera, as well, right? So what people want every year, I tell you what they really, what makes them come to the ground. It isn't, well, we've just signed, you know, some bloke from South Africa or whatever, most of whom, you know, people have never heard of, because if you ask people to write down more than 10 South African
most
players,
of them I haven't heard of.
Hardly anybody will be able to do it.
Yeah, agree.
Right, so I don't buy that sometimes, right? That doesn't exist. But what they really want, what makes them get out their armchair and go to the ground or watch it on television is hope.
Yes, it's hope. Agreed.
It's about this year, with a bit of luck and injuries not too bad, and the new coach looks quite tidy, and we've got some good youngsters coming along. And you know what? We back end of last year, we put a couple of games together. This year we've got a chance. Now we should be concentrating on creating a league that creates that.
Yes.
For virtually every team in it, and at the same time sorting out the business model so that we're not constantly in financial crisis. And if that means that for a while, which is just what the French did, mm-hmm. if that means for a while you let a very small slither at the top go and ply their trade elsewhere and say, oh, but by the way, you can't play for England, I've got absolutely no problem with
it. Yeah, I do. It's a double-edged sword, right? So if the unions want to do that, they have to accept the consequences of doing it. So what I mean by that is, if you just follow the way that I think about this, like the logical path, I started watching rugby. I remember the first game of club rugby that I watched. I watched Northampton Saints play. And I was blown away because I was able to watch Paul Grayson play. And why was I blown away by that? Because the week before, he nearly broke the record for the most points in an England jersey, and I think he played against Romania. So I knew I liked rugby. I knew I wanted to play it. And if England were on, I watched England. And Paul Grayson and Matt Dawson absolutely nailed it. Next week, Northampton were on. I thought, right, going to watch that. So I think what we're saying is, yes, the players are going to go to France. Some of the best players will go to France. Once Owen Farrell goes, I think that is really the floodgates opening. When Owen Farrell says England's not that important, I'm gone, that is a problem. So if England are not winning, that's also a problem for growing the game. If England are winning and their best players are coming from France, which absolutely could be a thing, when the next kid turns on the TV and sees Owen Farrell from Racing, such and such from Toulouse, Tom Willis from Toulouse, whoever it is, their natural inclination is going to be to watch those teams. But that's just what it's going to be.
But my very point is, and maybe we disagree, which is good.
Mm.
I support the ban that you don't get picked if you don't play in the Premiership. I'm in favour of it.
I support it until it.
And so what you've just argued doesn't happen, because you make a choice. You want to go and play. It doesn't have to be France. You want to go and play in Japan. You want to go and play Super Rugby. Fine.
It works.
You know, fine.
It's like,
if you want to be James Haskell, fine.
Yeah. Thing
and
is,
do it
Mark,
for the experience. Yeah. That's great. Whilst you're doing that, you're not playing for England.
Thing is, Mark, these market interventions, which is effectively what they are, it's like the saying about banks, which is banks fail very slowly and then very quickly. And the best example of this is Australian rugby. So Australian rugby has got some rules. It does allow players from overseas. And it is slowly creaked, and then in the World Cup, absolute catastrophe. Now, there are other reasons. You can't lose three tighter props. You can't lose 140-kilogram second row. It's difficult. But it was an absolute catastrophe. And that union has been hollowed out now. Now, you mentioned the age 28, and I think that's a really interesting age, because I think the same thing. I think that international rugby is effectively based on potential, right? So the coaches and the unions look at the players they have and think, God, we want these young lads with potential, and they're okay with letting go the senior players. All that's going to happen is that age of 28 is going to come on to 27, 26, 25. And then when they realise that they don't have a shot, then they leave.
And as long as England build upon its inbuilt natural advantage, which is the sheer number of junior players.
Yeah.
I mean, age group players.
Yeah, agreed.
It will not be a problem.
Yeah.
England has got many problems in the way its rugby is constructed, but a lack of a number of players simply isn't one of them. And I find it deeply ironic and more than a little irritating that this whole thing about, oh my God, that's what we've got to stop. That's what all I hear is either with to be fair, I have heard one or two voices saying that actually it meant there are lots of very good reasons why lots of countries limit people playing for the country if they don't play in the domestic comp, which is what I'm arguing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then, but the vast majority of voices seem to be saying either this is outrageous, we should pick them from anywhere,
mm-hmm.
which I think will only open the floodgates.
Yep.
Right. Because players will just go then if there are no consequences of going. By definition, you know, follow the incentives. You say it all the time,
yeah.
And that bit I agree with. Right? If there are no disincentives for going, more will go. Right? Which I don't really want. I don't think that's very good for the country, rugby. Right? For a whole host of reasons. Right? But don't get obsessed about trying to keep everybody. It won't be nearly as many as you think, unless you decide that there is no price to pay. You can have your cake.
Oh, no, no, I think we're saying the same thing.
You can go and play for the biggest yeah. club in the world. Go and play for Toulouse, and you can still play the Six Nations, and you can still play. You know, you can still play for England.
Well, I mean, I think we're saying the same thing,
that
right?
Could
which
be
is there are consequences to actions. I just think the more severe consequences eventually will be to the unions, particularly the international unions.
Why? Why do you think? Where do you think? I mean, I've heard you say it many times. You know, the thing about English rugby is, of course, we could pick 10 wingers and there's not an awful lot of difference between them.
No, there's not, is there?
You could pick six scrum halves and, you know, they'd all do a decent job. Actually, it's more about cohesion and coaching and culture and team spirit and all that other intangible stuff and how good the coach is and all that kind of stuff, right? So why, I don't understand why English rugby would worry if a relatively small number of people, of players, chose to go play elsewhere and give up the chance for an international appearances for 2, 3, 4 years, or if they're well into their 30s, it's effectively an international retirement.
Yeah, when you're in your 30s,
that's what it is.
Yeah, when you're in your 30s, do what you want. I don't really care.
So
let me just
point this out. From a personal preference,
right? Personal morality preference, play anywhere. Right, but that's not my view necessarily when it comes to how you grow the game in England and how you grow the club game. I think you need to construct something which is suitable for the situation that we have. I mean, I talk about this all the time. The goal for English rugby should be to produce as many young players as they possibly can because they're cheap on the salary cap, and then if they want to go elsewhere, I mean, if you've got a whole market of great players, fine. Absolutely fine, but even then,
and they're not bad, but there's improvements that could be made. If England got top class pathway and development programs in place,
yep,
and I'm not saying they're terrible, they're not, but they could be better. That would have far, far more impact on the international prospects of the country over a period of time than paying money the clubs and the union can't afford against a much, much bigger market that's only 26 miles away. In the same way, mm-hmm. where I'm from, where, you know, the Welsh clubs who struggle to keep their players from going an hour over the border, where they speak the same language,
yeah.
and you can still live in South Wales if you're mum or your girlfriend so desires.
And the infuriating,
that's a far, far bigger challenge.
And the infuriating part about the Welsh situation is that I think on one Premiership weekend, I counted 7 Welsh 10s playing in England. Now, if I'm Welsh, which I notionally am in some ways, I think that's amazing. I mean, we, you know, if every jersey in the French top 14 was filled by an English fly half, that's absolutely fantastic for England. You know, there's always more than one way to look at these things.
We're going to disagree, but we've sort of gone down the rabbit hole of going to France, and
our best podcasters and our best players.
And I think that, you know, it's not. If I was making a list of 10 things I'd fix, or 10 things I'd change, rather, to improve the game in, let's just say, England for the moment, try, you know, opening the floodgates and letting players play wherever they want because we want Jack Willis back, mm-hmm, would not make my top 10.
Yeah, but I want multiple. Well, look, I don't really care where he plays. I think at some point there's going to be...
Neither do I. Can't play for England unless he plays in the Premiership.
Oh, absolutely fine. But then if England want to turn into Australia in the future, be my guest. I mean, I'm completely...
But they won't, JB, because it's a false comparative.
All I want to see is the best possible rugby. Now, if that rugby happens to naturally develop in the top 14, you'll probably be seeing me watching a lot more top 14. If it happens to be in the Premiership, I'll watch it. And that's how it will be. I don't think any rugby institution has the divine right to be good, whether that be the international game, the Premiership, or top 14. You know, the top players will find their way to the top teams, and the top teams will become top teams, and, you know, we'll all end up watching them, whether it be Leinster through their model, Toulouse through their model, or yet to be discovered model for England. But they've got to find the model.
Well, I think the people say, you know, why is English, you know, and obviously it's been coming for a long time, but the fate of Wasps and Worcester and London Irish, and one should not forget Jersey either. Those were body blows. And if we can just extend it out, we can't go on too much longer, but I do see one or two, I'm not completely, you know, I do see one or two signs of hope. And I've been arguing for the best part of 20 years that one of the things that the league should bring in, and this is the league, not, I hasten to say, the RFU, but, you know, the DNACG in France, which basically it's their financial controlling body, which has been around for years and years and years, and has, you know, relegated such, at times, big clubs like Grenoble and Bourgoin, countries, and clubs like that. You know, we are at least two decades behind. People going about the French and how much better it was, a different system. A lot of that is outside of your control. It's about the size of your market.
Yeah. But
some things aren't, and those are the things you should look at. Other things that we could do, even though our rugby market's only about half the size of the French rugby market. Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes, there are. And number one on my list would be an independent financial control body. Like the DNACG, one of the biggest, we started talking about debt, didn't we? The amount of debt that the clubs in England are carrying. You can't do that in France.
Yeah.
It won't give you a license. Okay. You have to clear the debt every year. Okay. Or you have to put the money up every year. And, you know, I saw last year that they were, that it was announced that Martin Phillips, I think it was announced, that they just appointed a chap. Is it Nigel Borden? I think that was the fella's name. Who's a very, very, very eminent corporate lawyer, who I see had been appointed to put together some financial reforms for the clubs and for the league. Now, I haven't seen anything since that was announced, and I'm not, as I say, I'm a long way away. But if that were to come to fruition, I'd say that was really promising because at the moment, and goodness me, didn't Worcester show this, we've got a distinct lack of financial regulatory control in the league, and we have paid a very, very heavy price for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, it just goes back to start the podcast, I guess.
Agreement, maybe we should finish.
Yeah, well, who would have thought that the point of agreement would be the French are a model of the French and Bernard Laporte are a model of financial probity.
Oh, I think in a way you could argue the shenanigans in French club rugby going back to the 1920s and clubs like Quillan was the very reason why the DNACG actually came into being. Sometimes, you know, it's the ideas that, no, we can't let that lot police themselves is probably a good starting point.
Excellent. Well, yeah, I think we should leave it there. What I love about these podcasts is I've got my list of questions here and I've asked none of them, which is tremendous. It's always a good sign.
It's all right, mate. I've got my list of notes here and I've touched on about a third of them, but there we are.
Excellent. All right. Well, until next month when we'll get back together. I'll just tell everyone you can contact us at contacteggchasers@gmail.com. I will definitely forward more of the emails from this week's podcast. I didn't last month. Any questions, any feedback, let us both know. We do read them. And we will catch up on the first Tuesday of next month.
Take care. All the best.